Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Education Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Long list of bills today. Let me give you the order we're going to go through. The first five or six will be pretty quick housekeeping measures, but we're going to take up first Senate Bill 170, Senate Joint Resolution 4, Senate Bill 18, Senate Bill 240, Senate Bill 333, Senate Bill 801, Senate Bill 245, which will be carried over, and Senate Bill 927. And we'll get these housekeeping bills out of the way first, and then we'll get to 927. So, let's start with work session on Senate Bill 170.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 4 without recommendation as to passage to the Senate Committee on Rules.
170.
What's that? Well, 170 first?
Yep.
I withdraw that motion. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 170 without recommendation as to passage to the Senate Committee on Rules.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 170 be moved to Rules Committee without recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Objection? So ordered. I'll open up a work session on Senate Joint Resolution 4.
Mr. Chair, I now move Senate Joint Resolution 4 without recommendation as to passage to the Senate Committee on Rules.
Senator George moves that SJR 4 go to the Rules Committee without recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none. So ordered. And I would like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 18, our referral to Ways and Means. Did you want to...
There's an emotion, a motion that we need to amend it.
Yeah, we need an amendment on 18.
Yes,
first.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that ready to go?
Okay. I can read.
Sure.
A very quick summary. Senate Bill 18 is part of the Measure 68 General Bond Obligation implementation. It establishes statutory provisions required for the Superintendent of Public Instruction to borrow money for the capital cost of school districts. We do have an amendment, -2, and that incorporates the -1 amendment and replaces the Department of Administrative Services with the Department of Education, defines internal revenue code terms, and removes an outdated qualified revenue bond category. Ready to amend.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 18, dated April 13, 2011.
Senator Bonamici moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 18. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator
Bonamici? Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Moore? Senator Hatt? Aye. The amendment is adopted. Senator Bonamici?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 18 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 18 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Yes, amended.
As amended. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Senator
George?
No.
Senator
Hill?
Aye.
Senator
Hill?
Aye.
Is
Mark
going to
get excused?
Yes. Senate Bill 18 moves to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Okay, I want to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 240, a public hearing and work session. If we have no one here, we'll just go into work session.
Mm-hmm.
Linda, if you could give us a brief summary and the effect of the amendment.
Correct. Senate Bill 240 requires school districts to develop the policy prohibiting harassment, intimidation, or bullying and prohibiting cyberbullying. Requires school employees to report hostile acts, allows voluntary and anonymous reporting by students and volunteers, and requires the school to prominently post the policy. There's a -1 amendment to Senate Bill 240. This amendment deletes references to reporting to law enforcement, increased remedial actions for conspiracy or additional acts of harassment, intimidation, or bullying or acts of cyberbullying.
Thank you. Is there anyone here wishing to testify on 240's amendment? Senator Bonamici, on the amendment?
I support the amendment, Mr. Chair and committee, because there was some concern raised about whether the employees in the school how they would be able to determine whether or not a particular incident may have violated a criminal statute. So there were some concerns raised by some of the people who were affected by the bill that they would be under an obligation that they wouldn't know how to comply with it. And Mr. Chair, I know that there are mandatory reporters about abuse, and so I think that we're covered on that, and I think there's some good provisions in the bill, even without those reporting requirements, so I support the Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 240, dated April 14, 2011.
Senator George moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 14, 2011 to Senate Bill 240. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
We're not doing anything with the Dash 2s. Forget it. Okay.
I think there's a Dash 2. Is there a Dash 2?
No. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 240 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 240 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 240 passes as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Verger will be the carrier. And I will close that work session. Okay.
333.
Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 333, a public hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 333. Linda, would you refresh us?
Yes. Senate Bill 333 establishes the Oregon Teacher Effectiveness and Career Enhancement Initiative Program within the Department of Education. There was a Dash 2 amendment which directs preparation of a plan to encourage national board certification for teachers. It renames the Professional Organization Certification Program as the National Board Certification Fund and sets purpose of fund to promote national certification of teachers. Creates the Educator Preparation Improvement Fund to improve preparation of teachers. Directs the Standards Practices Commission and the Oregon Department of Education to create a comprehensive leadership development system for licensed teachers that meets specific criteria. Directs preparation of guidelines for uniform set of core model teaching standards.
Okay, we have a Dash 2 amendment.
We adopted that previously.
It's already in.
Yes.
Okay. And we have the fiscal paperwork in order.
Okay, are we in work session?
Yeah, we are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 333 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 333 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections?
I just have a question, Mr. Chair. We adopted the Dash 2, but there's a Dash 3. Are we not considering those?
There's a Dash 3?
Figure out what we're doing. There's a...
To this one.
Dash 2.
There's a... I have the Dash 2 from last time, but there's a Dash 3.
Is there a Dash 3?
It's a Dash 3. Never mind.
There was a Dash 3?
Nope. I misread it.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. My apologies.
Senator George?
Too many threes in there.
I already made the motion, didn't I?
We are in discussion. Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 333 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We're down to me. I'll carry this bill.
Okay.
Close the work session. Here's my list.
I'm
going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 801.
could give us a brief summary.
Actually, the bill is pretty brief in itself. We were looking at some amendments on this committee, and alas, we have none.
801 directs the State Board of Education to adopt guidelines for best practices of administering statewide assessments of students. And there were no amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 801 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 801 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 801 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Bonamici, you're the chief sponsor on this. Would you like to carry this?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session and move to Senate Bill 245, which we are carrying over until Thursday. And we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 927.
Oh, no, 175.
Oh, I apologize. I guess I'm just so anxious to get there. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 175. We have some people to speak on this briefly before. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Shall we begin?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, Chair House and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 175. As you may remember, we were here several weeks back at the end of a session offering some initial testimony, and were invited back to finish our presentation. My name is Agnes Balassa. I'm with the Oregon Workforce Partnership. We're the Association of Oregon's seven local workforce boards with a mission of creating a more highly skilled workforce for Oregon and its industries. And Senate Bill 175 specifically focuses on two proposals we had for this specifically that are effective in this type of an economy. One is to create a summer youth employment program or a youth employment program. The other is to create an employer workforce training fund. Both of them are designed based on research, return on investment potential, and the fact that they actually either help keep people in the workforce or give youth the opportunities, the skill, to move into the workforce at a time when it's very challenging for them to have those opportunities based on the economy. In the interest of time, we've narrowed down the number of speakers that we have, so you'll see testimony from more than the individuals that I have with me today. I have Dennis Luneski, who's a previous participant of the Youth Employment Program, as well as Barbara Bessie, who has facilitated a consortium of businesses who took advantage of the Employer Workforce Training Fund based on past pilots and past investments in these programs. So we're here today to speak in support of the measure, and what I'd like to do is just quickly hand it over to my other two speakers so that they have an opportunity to share the benefits that they're aware of as a result of participating.
Agnes, before you do that, just could you update our committee on the effect in your mind of this amendment?
Yes.
As to the original bill.
Right. So there was an amendment that was developed to the bill originally had three components. And there was an amendment to focus on just the two, the creation of the Summer Youth Employment Program and the Employer Workforce Training Fund, without the on-the-job training program. The on-the-job training program is already in the governor's budget, and so it didn't seem like we needed to move a separate bill forward on that one. Our fault, that should have been introduced to you at the last opportunity we had to talk about that. So I apologize. That was something that we didn't get carried through all the way.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
So I would like to introduce Dennis Luneski and Barbara Bessie. Which one of you would like to go first?
Mm-hmm. I go, Dennis?
Oh, we do. David.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas, committee members. My name is David Luneski. I would like to, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about the importance of the summer jobs program for the youth. I myself got into the summer work program because at the time I was homeless and trying to get by in Cottage Grove after graduating high school. Earning a living in a small town such as Cottage Grove can be very difficult, particularly when you have no work experience. The summer work program enabled me to gain the experience that I desperately needed in order to be successful in society, and thanks to the real work experience I gained, I was able to get a rewarding job working for IBM Event Services.
I was also able to ascertain my goals in life due to inspiration provided by Aprovecho, where I was working at through the program. Through interaction with the staff, I have decided to pursue a career in homeopathic medicine, and I'm currently working to achieve that goal. Do you have any questions?
We'll hold our questions to a while.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, and I'm Barbara Bessie. I'm the director of the Small Business Development Center at Lynn Benton Community College and the coordinator of the Willamette Valley Bioscience Consortium. For the last 2 years, 2009 and 2010, we used employee workforce training funds of about $78,000 to train members of that consortium. We reached 22 companies, almost 300 employees, and we trained at two levels. We trained first technicians in FDA regulations, in how to run a company and an operation that requires that high level of control and quality. And we focused on training executives on innovation and opportunities for collaboration. As a result, we have chartered the Willamette Life Science Collaborative, which is a partnership between three private companies, Oregon Freeze-Dry, Tech Laboratories, and Samaritan Health, and Oregon State University's Office of Technology Transfer and College of Pharmacy, and Lynn Benton Community College for Workforce Development. We have products in the pipeline. We are developing toward solutions for healthcare. Companies are already expanding their production lines and adding jobs. The revenue stream is pretty exciting that will come from this, and we did that with $78,000, saving the companies hundreds of thousands of dollars in training costs. So any questions? I'm happy to answer.
Questions of our panel? Comments?
We have your amendment here, and this does not call for funding
right,
in this
we
version. And we can adopt your amendment. But you do not have the necessary formal paperwork to move it to the floor. So, we won't be able to do that today. But we will be able to vote on the amendment and move it out on Thursday, committee willing. So, Senator Morris, we're in a work session on.
We're in work session. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment, Senator 175, dated February 18, 2011.
Senator Morris moves the -1 amendment dated February 18, 2011 to Senate Bill 175. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you.
I'll
close the work session on Senate Bill 175.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 927. Linda, if you could give us a quick summary.
Quick.
Okay, summary.
A summary. The original bill, 927, establishes the Oregon Option Consortium within the Oregon Department of Education for the purpose of providing online courses to students in kindergarten through grade 12. It establishes Oregon Option Advisory Committee, directs Advisory Committee to establish standards and requirements for the Oregon Option Consortium, provides requirements for charter school related to provisions of online courses, and allows public charter schools to become established as virtual alternative education programs, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011. There have been three amendments, but the latest is -3 amendment, and it has substantially changed the entire bill. And I'm sure the people speaking to this will get into more detail. I will just give a few outlines of what it does. It establishes the Oregon Option Consortium within the Oregon Virtual School District. It outlines the consortium providers and membership requirements. It establishes the advisory committee for the purpose of establishing standards and requirements related to courses, teachers, and operations. It outlines providers and courses provided through the consortium. It discusses student access, records, programs, waivers, residency, and eligibility. The OVSD responsibilities are outlined. There's a fund established. It revises Chapter 338 on charter school law, removing references to virtual charter schools. It bars establishment of new virtual public charter schools, allows a public charter school to provide online courses by purchasing courses from the consortium, defines virtual alternative education program for instruction outside the consortium, sets quality standards for virtual alternative education programs, and ensures that virtual alternative education teachers are licensed teachers. It also declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011.
Thank you. I think what we wanted to do was to start with the department for just a scene setter.
Yeah. Autumn? Oh, I guess Autumn's sending.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to come before you today. For the record, Autumn Wilburn, Oregon Department of Education. I want to start out by thanking the OEA for working with us on the latest amendment to this bill and working on this bill with us. A little bit of background for you. Oregon Virtual School District, which is one of the things that this bill affects, in the past, in 2009-11, received $1.8 million in funding. In the state school fund budget that was passed by both the Senate and the House last week, that amount has been reduced to $1.58 million. So we are looking at a reduction in funding for the virtual school district. We're here today to talk to you about what the Oregon Virtual School District currently does. You also have a one-pager in front of you that I submitted to the committee staff. And I'm joined at the podium today by Steve Nelson. He's the chief IT strategist for the department, and he oversees the Oregon Virtual School District. And I also have with me Rachel Wente-Cheney, and she works for the High Desert ESD, but how she fits in the picture is she is the Oregon Virtual School District trainer. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Nelson. I'm the program administrator of the Oregon Virtual School District Program in the Department of Education. I'm going to be brief with a short overview and then let Rachel talk about the training efforts, some of the support issues that we encounter and work through with teachers so they can enable the resources that you've made available to ODE through OVSD. The OVSD program services are provided by the Department of Education at no additional cost to public schools. Currently, we are serving 123,000 plus student and teachers in the portal. You'll often hear that OVSD is a library of content. That is true. It is also much more. OVSD provides teachers and students in public online schools with applications and courses for blended classroom instruction, distance learning programs instruction, as well as the training for teachers and administrators, and help desk support services for teachers so they can successfully utilize what's been put in place. We do operate a content repository. That repository includes 90 courses. It includes 19,000 instructional videos and lectures and 400 animated lessons. In our system, the teacher controls access and use. So when they select a course, they enroll their students. They control everything in terms of what the student sees, how the instruction is done, when the assessments with a small a are conducted. And so they are the control point. That's really important in terms of protecting students' records and certainly the privacy, well, in addition to the privacy issues, keeping them in a safe environment for online learning. And the goal is to support those online programs in public education, as well as bring those traditional tools into the classroom, extend the classroom day, and allow students to work with the same content that they're working in the classroom, outside of the classroom. OVSD, in short, provides everything except the teacher. We train the teacher, we provide them with content and portal services for communication and the hosting of content and administering it, and they are the teacher, we are not. One of the big efforts in this program that the Superintendent of Public Instruction made clear is that we need to maximize the funds that you appropriate for OVSD. We've taken that very seriously. For the past biennium, for every one public dollar invested in OVSD services, we're able to leverage $2.40 through public-private partnerships with companies like Google, Smart Learning, the SaaS company that provides curriculum pathways, and that's one piece of our public-private partnerships. The public side of that is really important. We have very rich relationships with higher education through Oregon State University, through the educational service districts, which Rachel is representing today. Rachel is the manager of our training program. She trains, but she also manages a consortium of ESDs throughout the state that provide training services for teachers and for administrators, again, to successfully utilize it. One of our key partnerships is offering Google applications for education to school districts. We're also in the middle of negotiating a similar cloud services agreement with Microsoft to find those tools that are readily available and companies that we can work with to incorporate the federal requirements for record safety and records privacy and student safety. Which is key in those agreements, they don't exist. And so we spend a lot of time working with them. We provide the training and the help desk resources on Google Apps for Education, and we'll support the Microsoft rollout when we finish that in any way we can. Google, as you know, provides a suite of applications, including email, online document creation, including spreadsheet, and they provide communication applications. Again, the school district controls all those services, how they're used, when they're used, who has access to it. So we allow the public schools to be in charge and administrate that. Sharing the control has been very successful for us in OVSD. I mentioned that higher ed is a key partner with us. Oregon State University's Open Source Lab provides the application hosting, development, and senior administration for our system. Our system is currently based on open source software to extend those dollars, and we'll be rolling up Microsoft services, I'm sure, very soon. We answer the needs of the schools for the applications they want to use, the content they want to utilize, and what services they need. And with that, I would invite Rachel to spend a little bit of time talking about our training program.
So, hello. Again, my name is Rachel Winty Cheney, and I'm actually here, in case the confusion didn't make it apparent, in a couple of roles. I'm actually the Chief Information Officer for the newly formed Shared Services Technology Consortium that it includes Crook County School District, Redmond School District, Sister School District, and High Desert ESD. Part of my role as CIO is to play the training team lead for the Oregon Virtual School District through a contract from the Oregon Department of Education. And I have spent the past 2 years out speaking and training and talking to our districts, large and small, our school boards, our Oregon School Boards Association, administrators, and even students and families. When I was driving here, I was driving from Prineville this morning, and I think it was fate that Oregon Public Broadcasting, the Talk Out Loud, Think Out Loud program, they had a segment on volunteers, and one of the individuals speaking was a member of the Oregon Board of Education. And the example that he brought up, and the show was actually about volunteering, it wasn't about online learning or anything like that, but the example that he brought up was the struggle that our districts are facing statewide in how we're moving our education forward with these digital tools and with online learning options and the confusion that is faced at the district level, whether they be large or small. And I see that every day when we go out and train. We hear administrators who are wondering how they move forward, how they do it safely, how they still allow their districts to flourish, but also allow their individual students to reach as high as they need to. And so that's what we've really done with the Oregon Virtual School District, is taken that first step in working through governance and safety issues for the school districts when they're using, whether it be cloud services or a hosted Moodle platform, which Moodle is an online classroom, similar to a Blackboard online classroom management system. So I feel proud of the work we've done the past year, and actually the past 2 years, in trying to bridge some of those questions and help some of those small districts. Again, I was in Joseph 2 weeks ago. We have members of our training team in Pine Eagle and in Vail this week, and also the Portlands and the Beavertons and Salem-Keizer school districts as we move forward with these cloud tools and online blended, hybrid, and essentially classroom model softwares.
So I think with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Questions? So, George? How does this bill then move you forward?
It's a great question, Chair Haas. As we understand it, this bill, and I want to say that I haven't yet had a chance to thoroughly review the latest amendment. So this bill does three different things, and one of the things that it does is it addresses the Oregon Virtual School District. So that's the part that I would like us to speak to. And Steve, would you please address how this affects the Oregon Virtual School District?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in answer to your question, Mr. Chair, the way this will affect it is some known, some unknown to me, not having seen the amendments, but had some discussions. What I do know is it continues a partnership we have with the Southern Oregon ESDs, Oregon Online, the consortium of ESDs that provide the ORVID program. Hosted by Northwest Regional Educational Service District. It allows us to, well, we continue doing that work to lower the cost of ownership for the online schools. It brings into focus, I think, some of the issues more directly related to public education outside of the other two-thirds of the bill. You know, watching 6 years, we've been locked in the other two-thirds of the bill. What it does is it raises the public policy issue, I think, for education as the enterprise to return its focus to 560,000 students in class and in the public school setting. That's the best I can do right now, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Von Mucci.
Thank you. I'm going to ask, I think, Mr. Nelson, you mentioned that you're currently serving about 123,000 students. I think that's what you said. Is this bill intended to increase the number of students that you serve, and if so, by how much?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, let me answer it this way. The biggest increase factor for OVSD was the state signing a contract with Google for Google Apps for Education. The next big jump in this will be when we sign an agreement with Microsoft. That does cost prevention for school districts and opens up new incredible tools that we could never begin to think about building as the public sector. This bill, I would presume, would increase the utilization for those the other side of the OVSD house, which is the 123,000 teachers and students served. The public programs that we currently have using OVSD, like ORVID, like Oregon Online, it allows them potentially to serve more students. It's a little bit of an unknown to me, but we work cooperatively with everybody we can. With the scarce resources available, do not have the luxury of picking and choosing on any issue. It's the requirements of school districts and students and teachers, and then what we can do to remove barriers and increase options.
Thank you. Can I ask a follow-up question? And of the students who are currently being served, can you talk a little bit about, are they elementary school students, high school students, middle school students? What type of curriculum? I just want to get a sense of who's being served now.
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, in the current program, it's a voluntary program, and the way that it is adopted is teacher by teacher. It is Rachel Winty Cheney, Corinne Richards from the Willamette ESD, Paul Nelson from the Northwest Regional ESD, Virginia Pettit from the Southern Oregon ESD, using enticement and convincing through what's available teachers to use this. And currently, what you get from that is an uneven adoption. These are big numbers. By and large, they are high school. The 90 courses I described are high school focused. We have three courses that are middle school focused. And what we've done with the limited resources is start at the top in terms of matriculation and move down. And out of those, when you look at it, there are a surprisingly number of elementary schools, and I'd be happy to provide you with a full list of the schools that use it and what their numbers are, if that would help you and the committee members. But it varies. What happens is we hopefully find the teachers that are ready for this and are successful with it, and then it turns into something that's viral in a school setting. One teacher talks to another teacher, and it's a good opportunity to increase student engagement.
Thank you.
I know you're following this, Autumn, so to help us along, there is also an online bill that's moving through the House. Can you summarize what that does? And
Senator Haas, thank you for that. Also, House Bill 2301 is scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session tomorrow in the House Education Committee. And that is a conglomeration of the State Board of Education's white paper that they released last year on online learning, and also some other ideas as well. So it is definitely different than the Senate bill that's in front of you today.
Is the department supportive of that?
We're also neutral on that bill, Chair Haas.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
So let me call up Jim Sager and Lori Wimmer and your team. Rachel stays.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association and its 45,000 members. You'll have my written testimony in a moment. I'm here to do just a quick overview, but one of the things I wanted to make sure that I say first of all is that we are speaking to the Dash 3 amendments, which is a total rewrite of the bill that grandfathers in all the current virtual charter schools operating in Oregon today. And that's, I think, an important piece. You'll hear from others concerns about closing their schools. That is not our intent. And so with that said, let me tell you what this bill does intend to do, as exemplified by the Dash 3s. We hope to provide all public education students access to cutting-edge, cost-effective, and high-quality online learning in the public school setting. The idea and the vision for this came about as a result of a pilot that you'll be hearing about momentarily, initiated by the Northwest Regional ESD at the request of their component school districts, but which has been a runaway hit and has quickly gone viral, and we would love to see it basically expanded statewide, building on the state's six-year multi-million-dollar investment in the Oregon Virtual School District that you heard about. The distinction between what this is and what they already do is think of it as the library of books. This is the library of books that comes with a curriculum and a teacher. A highly qualified Oregon licensed teacher who is professionally trained to deliver online instruction and to students on a course-by-course basis. As you probably know, under Oregon's charter school law, if you offer an online program, it must be a comprehensive, all-day, full-meal deal kind of education. You can't do course-by-course, and that is how this program would be different, is that it enables students to, on a case-by-case basis from K through 12, take courses in online education while still remaining a public school student enrolled in the resident school district, participating in sports, theater, band. You can't take tuba lessons on the computer. having social interactions with their fellows and so on. Although a student could, under our bill, conceivably take all their courses online, even through this. The idea is that if you think of going into a restaurant and opening a menu, you look at all of your range of options and you order your dinner or your lunch. We have the same vision with a statewide or
Oregon Option Consortium, that any provider, public or private, that agrees to be a member of the consortium at the fee basis, at the quality standard level, could offer courses that then school districts could purchase with their general funds on behalf of the student. Right now, I think you'll hear that that's running about $300 a course. I would say that that probably will change slightly in order to accomplish making moot any fiscal impact to the Department of Education for rulemaking and the role they will play in expanding Oregon Virtual School District to handle the payment transfers and so on, so that we can make sure that they are reimbursed for their actual expenses. The idea, though, is to make sure that students have, we have a vision that, in theory, as this develops over time, you could have a course that isn't quite full enough to be able to offer in a brick-and-mortar setting because of low demand, say a calculus course or a physics course, that could still be offered to the 15 or so students who still want it by adding to that class 15 other kids virtually to the actual students involved so that you maximize the efficiency of school district offering. Also, so there are lots of ways this consortium could, down the road, expand and be the most efficient, high-quality way of offering online classes to those who are in public schools. We believe that this carefully balances Oregon's fiscal realities, our accountability and transparency and quality standards under Oregon law, and student demand for greater options in how to access online learning while still maintaining their ability to be in the schools they love. You'll note that another part of the bill moves the future potential providers of online education out who do not choose to be a part of the consortium to the alternative ed statutes in 336 rather than the charter school statutes in 338 because in the interim online task forces it was the view of virtually everybody that there were logistics problems with providing it through the charter school law. But as I said, we grandfather the existing programs that have used that law because we understand that some folks believe that that's the business model they would want to continue to pursue, and we have no desire to close anybody's school. And so if you do adopt the Dash 3s, we'll make sure that that alternative ed program piece is prospective only. But I would point out that the Insights program is already operating in Oregon using the alt-ed law and has contracts with, I believe, about 45 school districts to provide online education on contract with those school districts. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but first I'll pass it off to Mr. Sager to talk a little bit more about how this all, what the genesis of this program is and how it's operating through the Northwest Regional ESD and OBSD.
Thank you. For the record, I'm James Sager, Assistant Superintendent, Northwest Regional ESD. January 12th, 2010. That's the day I'll always remember because every month we have a regional superintendents meeting. All 20 of our superintendents meet with us and talk over issues. And we were already discussing the future funding challenges that districts were facing and how are they going to meet the needs of the various students. We were having a conversation about trying to have credit recovery programs and dual credit at the same time. And what about the schedules when we can't, as Lori said, allow the kids to be in van anymore because the calculus class lines up? They also discussed losing a great math teacher because this person was teaching the advanced math classes and Vernonia School District, for instance, which has a wonderful math teacher, doesn't have enough advanced math students to make the class pencil out financially. So now do you let that person go so you can teach lower level math? And so these were the challenges that we're facing. The meeting concluded with a directive from the 20 superintendents to me and my superintendent to create, and they wanted it up and running by September 1, a virtual option that would begin to address those kinds of questions. Seemed a little, seemed like a short timeline at that point. But within 72 hours of that decision and us sharing the decision with some others around the state, literally it went from being just a Northwest Regional ESD in our 20 districts to being a statewide issue. Many people Mark Mulvihill, who is now the new Intermountain merged ESD, and Dennis Dempsey from High Desert, said, hey, we've got our superintendents asking the same thing. There are districts that are trying to run their own program, and maybe they could benefit from being part of a consortium. There are other consortiums around the state that are operating. How could we all come together and really leverage our expertise and resources and ideas? So during the spring of 2010, the decision was to appoint Paul Nelson, who you've heard his name, and I will leave his written testimony here. He is the trainer that is in Pine Eagle today, so he couldn't be here, otherwise he'd be here to testify directly, to help us put this in place. So we surveyed the state, we looked at best practices, we laid out the requirements of the program, and if you go on our website, which stands for Oregon Virtual Education, it's ORVED.org, we lay out what our standards are, expectations, the process, etc. But September 1, we had ready, we had teachers trained, and we had six classes to begin offering. Now, it was awfully late. School was already starting, and so it's hard for districts to schedule students in. So, quite frankly, I think we started with 9 or 12 students, something of that nature, that were taking these classes. Right now, they're asynchronous classes, so they're beyond the school day, and kids can come in and out whenever they want. But there's a office time when they do connect on a at least a twice-a-week basis with the teacher and actually talk directly to the teacher. But we've gone from that to this semester, 200 students. We've already gone from that to this summer and next fall with Beaverton looking at having over 600 students involved with the program, Portland potentially in excess of 1,000 students. So we think by next fall it will have mushroomed to at least 2,000 students, and it just kind of continues to grow. So we are expanding by adding Mandarin Chinese. We now have a system in place to do that. Adding dual credit classes, we're working with the community colleges across the state. We're collaborating with them to make sure that the classes are either taught, but if not taught by their instructors, do meet their crediting standards so that the students will have credit. And I guess one point I just feel is important to emphasize, and which is why this bill, in my mind, makes a lot of sense. This isn't an entrepreneurial idea by Northwest Region or someone else. This is really an attempt to have a statewide umbrella, statewide consortium for the public system. So that whether, again, the Salem-Keizer School District that operates an online wants to continue to just to do it in-house, that's wonderful. If there are other providers that want to come in, what it does is it takes away the question factor for the superintendents or the principals. Because that was the biggest pushback we had, which is why the requirements that Lori mentioned were so important. I want to know, as a principal and a superintendent, are these certified teachers? Has the curriculum been vetted and meets the Oregon standards? Is there going to be a connection made between the student and teacher? Is this going to try to meet the highest best practices standards that we can find nationwide for online education? And so we designed it to meet that. But Northwest Regional doesn't have ownership. ESDs don't have ownership. We want this to be an ownership of the public system in the state of Oregon. And once again, we'll turn to Rachel, who can give a couple other ideas.
Hello again, Chair Haas and committee members. So again, I'm kind of playing that dual role and also representing some of the voices from the other side of the mountain range, where we don't have that economy of scale in many of our districts that a lot of the school districts in the metro area do. So Mr. Sager spoke about Mandarin language courses. Maybe AP Physics or AP Calculus, or courses that in a smaller district we can't fill or we can't hire teachers for, having an option like ORVED allows us to still have students who want those courses be able to take them, rather than in one district using Rosetta Stone software as the language delivery, actually having a teacher and those certifications and standards in place that this is a classroom. It may not look like the classroom that we've had for the last 150 years, but this is a classroom approach to those needs. As we look at this, when I was sitting here 5 minutes ago with the Oregon Virtual School District, ODE and Steve Nelson have done an amazing job setting up the infrastructure for teachers in hybrid models. So we have the actual servers and the software, the applications and the content that have been scaffolded over the past number of years. We focused on teachers in the district using those tools to provide that hybrid model of delivery, kind of in-class supplements, online materials they can post. We provide the training and support. The piece that's missing is that student piece and those student options. And this is where the Oregon Virtual Education fills that role and allows us to take that platform that's been built on the kind of blinky lights side with the actual servers and hardware and content and match it with the teachers and the courses that are needed statewide and really try to get to that economy of scale so that when we have students in Black Butte or students in Lakeview or students in Vail or Joseph or Pendleton or Bend or Redmond or Crook County or Sisters, we have some of those same access to classes as our peers in the metro areas where there is a greater concentration of teachers and subjects available. And I think it's incredibly important now as we're starting to look at the budgets for next year. And I've been in many board meetings and budget meetings where individual schools and school districts are having to make those critical decisions between keeping one program versus another versus course services and course subjects. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you explain to us on what the difference, what this will allow you to do that you can't do now, and what the state board bill over in the House will do to you that you can't do now?
Chair Haas, Lori Wimmer again for your record. We believe that what this will do is bring into a single place all of the public options and private providers who choose to be a part of the consortium as well, higher ed providers, community college providers, anyone who wishes to do this, as I said, into the same menu, as I mentioned before, so that all options that are of high quality are arrayed in one place so that it's easier for the department in its regulatory function to keep an eye on it. Y'all remember, of course, I'm sure, the Web Academy problems of last year. I think that we still have three agencies of government, the Department of Justice, the Secretary of State's Audit Division, and the Department of Ed, all investigating for that fairly rare but very serious malfeasance behavior of Web Academies. There needs to be a regulatory function, but with the kinds of budgets we're looking at, both at the school district level and inside the department, we felt that it would be really wonderful, not only from the students' vantage point of having all their choices arrayed together, but also from a regulatory efficiency standpoint to make sure that everything was in one place. And then secondarily, of course, there's the piece about the alternative ed statute being a better fit than the charter school. And that was also part of, I think, the Board of Education's recommendation, if I remember correctly, given the logistical issues around the charter school law with respect to only being able to do comprehensive. This way, districts also who have students in their resident area have a conversation about the best placement for the needs and interests of their children.
Chair Haas, if I might. In the strictest sense of the word, what we're doing with the Oregon Virtual Ed, we're going to continue with or without this bill. The relationship we have with the department, the relationship we have with school districts and ESDs and others around the state, we're going to continue. But as Lori was saying, not only the regulatory perspective, but what I have been told constantly from superintendents and principals is I would like to be able to go to one place where I know whatever's on this menu meets the requirements. We have the certified teachers, the curriculum's been reviewed, everything's in place, and I know that if I direct my counselors to sign kids up in those programs, That's all taken care of. I don't have to worry about it. The due diligence has already been done. And so that is, in my opinion, as a assistant superintendent, the most important piece. But we're going to continue to work and to leverage, but to be able to bring all that confidence throughout the public education system to know that they could go there would be a huge benefit, as well as regulatory oversight.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, one other point is that this bill also requires school districts to use their resources to provide that access for students for the first time.
In the board's bill?
I haven't seen it. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry?
The House bill, the state board's.
Yes, it does.
You're supportive of that bill?
No, I thought you asked me if they also do that requirement. Yeah.
Is the OEA supportive of that bill?
We believe that it has some technical difficulties. We support this bill.
Any questions? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who writes the course curriculum?
All of the curriculum that is listed on the Oregon Virtual School District platform has been curriculum that has been reviewed and approved by, we have review committees of teachers and administrators that review the material, and so it's downloaded and it's available there. The curriculum that we are using for the Oregon Virtual Education piece, the pieces have either been written by Oregon teachers and to meet the standards, and or currently being purchased through the Florida Virtual School District. They have a large operation in Florida where they actually have a virtual school district that's funded by the state system, et cetera. But they have a department of people that create curriculum. We had that curriculum aligned with Oregon standards and therefore entered into an agreement. Steve Nelson could give you more of the details on that, but that was curriculum that we decided we could use instantly. What Paul Nelson and Rachel and others have been doing is, I would say, beefing it up. In other words, aligning video and other kind of multimedia elements to that curriculum to make it even more engaging with the students.
Is there some reason you didn't access the private providers that have been providing curriculum in the state here?
When Paul Nelson and the committee of people we had reviewing this looked around, they looked for the pieces of curriculum that, from all the research, showed, you know, met the best practices of online education. And the virtual school district system, which has been in place, I think, at least 10 years, maybe longer, met all that criteria. And so, again, working with that district out of Florida, the arrangement was made between the state and Florida. But they reviewed a number of pieces. On the Oregon Virtual School District library, there are a lot of elements that, in fact, do come from private sector companies. And they're there, and people are constantly, the 123,000 students that Steve was talking about are constantly accessing those. The classes where we are actually virtually teaching the class currently happen to be Florida Virtual School classes, but it doesn't stop us at all from, in fact, we're looking at one of the advanced placement classes in order to create a dual credit U.S. history class working with the community colleges, and so we're looking at all those options.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, and to be clear, under this concept for the bill, any of the willing providers could come in to it, including the privates. That's in the bill.
Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, can I ask, Lori, would you mind explaining that just a little bit more?
Sure. The bill sets out an advisory committee that is composed of providers of all the education advocacy groups or representing teachers, school boards, the Department of Ed, other experts in the field. And the advisory committee would work with the Department of Ed and the Board of Ed to create rules and to create the criteria based on Oregon law that we already have in place around accountability, transparency, and quality standards, and would open up the application process to any provider that would like to offer through the consortium their services. So any program that's currently operating that wishes to be considered would just have to agree to do it for the rate approved by that advisory committee and at the quality standards level, and they would be on the list for potential selection by any given student in any given district.
Senator George.
I understand that what we're trying to do is create a clearinghouse where we can have lots of different options gathered, and so superintendents and principals and teachers can access.
Great.
But this, and I've just read it through the Dash 3s, but this bill is more of a regulatory bill regulating who can't access, this consortium, in essence. What we do is we limit the establishment of new charter schools. We limit the schools as far as who has to be licensed, who doesn't have to be licensed. There's all kinds of new regulatory actions in here. And instead of opening up the education process, creating a bundle that people can access with ease, what we're doing is we create this bundle, but then we totally regulate and restrict, even under the Dash 3s, who then can access that. It seems like the complete opposite of the direction we want to head. I don't have a problem with creating a process where we have a clearinghouse. It's a great idea. But I don't want to have a regulatory structure that shuts down that shuts down the opportunity to open up brand new charter schools, brand new educational opportunities, maybe have access from private schools that want to access it, homeschoolers that want to access it. It should be wide open. If we're going to do something like this, this should be about opening up opportunities, not creating a clearinghouse and then using that clearinghouse as leverage to shut down opportunities. So that's, I like the base idea, but this goes far afield later on, even in the Dash 3 amendments. So,
Senator House and Senator George, all we did is we transported existing law over to the new sections. The only thing about what you said that I concur with is that in the future we would not be creating new virtual alternative schools. However, that doesn't mean virtual providers couldn't come into Oregon. They would just do so under 336 instead of 338 in the statutes, which was a consensus item during the interim, and that's why we put it in our bill. The idea was to make it as smooth as possible to do that. And the state board bill does the same thing. They would no longer contemplate comprehensive virtual education being provided under the charter school model, if I'm remembering that correctly. That is a detail to me. That is not the main part of the bill. But the quality standards that are in there, including licensure, are already in current law.
Senator George.
So, I'm just going to take what you said, and I'm not trying to be difficult, but would then a friendly amendment be that we could rip some of those things out of current law in this bill? Could we provide an amendment that would take away some of the requirements for licensure and open this thing up more? Take the clearinghouse, but then get rid of some of this regulatory blockage to open up more charter schools and more opportunities. So we create this great clearinghouse, and then we get rid of some of these ridiculous licensure requirements, because I'd love to be able to bring people who are 65 years old, have tons of lifetime experience, and get them into the classroom. And I don't really care if they're licensed or not. They have a lifetime of experience. So can we use this vehicle as a way then to open up opportunities for those types of things?
Chair Hess and Senator George, if I could try to address that regarding the state's ability to allow more charter schools. Again, I sat on that interim work group that fought back and forth over, and kind of the consensus was, let's separate the idea of virtual and the idea of charter, and let's deal with them separately. So I would hope that this bill doesn't say you can't open charter schools in Oregon. That's a separate conversation. But on the virtual side, from the standpoint of a district administrator and looking at wanting to make sure that the highest quality standards are met for my students, I want to be able to go to one place where I know the standards have been met. You and I have a disagreement as to whether or not a person with life experience or other expertise can necessarily become a full-time teacher. I always use my oldest son, who is an amazing computer programmer. He just blows me away. Don't ask him to show you how to turn on your computer and find something, because 14 steps later, he'll be there and you'll have no idea how he got there and why. He's not a teacher, but he has a wonderful background. If he was teamed with somebody who knew how to translate that into a teaching environment and be a resource for that, that'd be wonderful. So here in Oregon, our standard has been that a person has to have both the subject matter expertise, but then also the ability and the training to teach. And that has been a standard as an assistant soup and the superintendents that we've talked to, which is why we created our pilot the way it is and why we support having that language here in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, especially with Lori, that we sat on the charter review interim work group and reviewed since 10 years since its passage, the charter school law. And this is a discussion that came up about including virtual education in the charter school bill. So could you talk, it's been a while since I looked at the alternative education statutes. Can you talk about the, sort of in general terms, about the differences of if somebody wanted to start a new school, but not as a charter, a new virtual school, but not as a charter school, how would they go about starting it under the alternative education statutes?
Chair Haas and Senator Bonamici, I'm not an expert in alternative ed, but my understanding is that the main distinctions are that you must make your contract with individual sending districts so that you are representing the needs and interests of the kids in those districts in the provision of your services. And the reimbursement rate is, I think, slightly different. I think it might be... I don't want to say. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. It depends on what the age of the child is, I think. In the brick-and-mortar alternative schools, they're both private and public alternative ed providers. Under this bill, in the Dash 3s and prior iterations, we would just say that that any private or public provider could become an alternative virtual education provider to offer comprehensive education or class-by-class education, and the difference would be that they would have to contract with the school districts. And as I said, we already have one virtual provider doing that. The Insights program does that in Oregon and has contracts with about 45 school districts and has already made that business model work for them. The best part about it is that it doesn't lock you into comprehensive. You can also do course by course.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, could I ask a follow-up? If you know, we reviewed the application and the renewal and termination, all those provisions in the charter school statute. How do the alternative school statutes compare in terms of the statutory barriers of setting up an alternative education program?
I'm an expert on it.
Okay. Well, I'll follow up on that. Thanks. Maybe somebody listening in the back might help me out with that. Maybe Cindy. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple of questions. How does the cost compare totally loaded overhead of your Florida curriculum versus what is available through our existing virtual schools that are operating independent of the Oregon virtual school?
Chair Haas, Senator Morse, I can tell you our cost structure, and I'm not sure what the cost, and I'll qualify that in a minute, but let me tell you our cost structure. For the regular middle school, high school classes, because we design these classes to be semester classes, it is $300 per student. The vast majority of that resource passes through the consortium to the school district where the teacher physically exists. So your school district may have a teacher teaching math. All 30 students may be spread out all over the state, but the consortium collects the $300 and then sends part of that to the district to compensate that teacher in the district. If they're not in a district, then currently what happens is Northwest Regional, we hire the teacher under our collective bargaining agreement, and we pay the teacher through that agreement. So the bulk of the cost goes to paying the teacher. So far, we've built this on less than a shoestring because of our partnership with the Department of Ed. Because the Oregon Virtual School District exists, they're able to buy or lease or rent, whatever agreement they come up with, the curriculum that's then put on the platform that then we access. So we haven't had any cost for that. So the only cost has been the cost for paying the teacher primarily. And Paul Nelson has been a half-time administrator because by law we have to have an administrator supervising teachers and evaluating them, et cetera. He's been our administrator, trainer, working with Rachel and others to have this consortium. So it is from the standpoint of overhead cost, very, very little, and I don't know how that compares with others. Now, the one comparison I do know is you can buy in a variety of programs what's called hot seats, and so there's this class being streamed over the internet. A student goes in either at home or maybe in a lab in the school or whatever and logs on, and it's they're alone taking this coursework, and that can range anywhere from gosh, $65 a seat to $125 a seat to, you know, even higher. So it depends upon what your goal of education delivery is. If you want that teacher interaction, which all the research says is absolutely paramount for student success, and if you want to make sure that it is meeting Oregon standards, that we have certified teachers, et cetera, the model we've created, we believe, is as tight as we can cut it, and so the cost is probably going to, you know, continue to be right there around $300. For the dual credit classes, our community colleges operate on a quarter basis. It looks like, in working with them, I've got a conference call today at 4 o'clock with them, that the cost there would be probably around $200 per class because it's on a quarter basis instead of semester, and again, the arrangements that are being created. So we're looking at what the specific program delivery is and, again, making sure that high quality exists.
As a follow-up, but you have not compared the cost of your delivery to the cost of what's existing today in virtual education.
Chair Hess, Senator Morris, again, that quite honestly wasn't our directive to just, you know, come in with the cheapest price. It was meet these standards and make the price as cheap as you can against those standards and that expectation.
There's another question. On page 7, lines 25 through 30, there's a limitation of 5%. Why would you limit the opportunity for students to 5%?
5% limitation.
The cap, Chair Hassan, Senator Morris, the cap was put in, actually, that entire section of what I call Mandate Light was put in and modeled identically to what we do with Oregon's expanded option law, which was also a mandate on school districts. The idea being that in these times with budget cuts, the difficulties that may exist in a district-by-district basis need to be accommodated, so we have an eligibility requirement. There's the cap, and then there's the release valve even from the cap for those students who, for example, suffer an illness or are on an IEP. But if the only two exceptions are for a two-year waiver, if there is a financial hardship or if there's a technological access impairment in that region of the state, which does exist in some parts of Oregon. But a district may exceed the cap. The mandate only holds for the cap.
And if I might, Senator Morris, I'm sorry, I'm thinking about your previous question. I just wanted to point out that the $300, if you were to roll it up to an annual cost for a typical high school student taking six classes totally online, that would come to $3,600, which is about 60% of what the ADM for that student is. So the difference is overhead and stuff that we don't have to pass on to the school district. They're able to keep those resources.
Just as a follow-up, I'm still troubled by caps.
Okay, sorry.
It should be based on, seemingly me, my judgment, based on the needs of the students. And we have districts of the state, you mentioned, that are not equal to the other districts. And CAPS just seems like a strange way to go.
Senator Hassan, Senator Morse, we modeled that on the basis of the state board's recommendation. They, too, had a cap. I think theirs was 3%, if memory serves. Ours is a little bit more generous on the student side. And I envision a day in which all students are able to get whatever it is they seek, whether it's to be the 31st student in a journalism class that closes after 30 and so that kid doesn't get journalism, or whether it is access to online classes in all cases, no questions asked, or any other program. We are regularly shutting students out of the things they would choose to do, whether in brick and mortar or other environments, because we're about to cut $1 billion out of schools and have suffered a 9% loss in the biennium prior to that, and in fact, since 2003, have been declining in our resources. So we acknowledge that that's a shame. We just are trying to deal with reality.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if I could, on what Senator Morse asked, but when in a situation like this, you're putting a cap on a lower-cost form of education. So in a moment ago, you said that the cost was $3,600 per student, and which is significantly less than what we currently provide, and then compared to what schools are paying all funds per student of, say, $11,000, it's a fraction. It's a third, roughly, of the cost. So it seems like to me, in this situation, you would want to remove any artificial cap and get as many kids into the education system that is cheaper and less expensive and appears to have equal or better results, and that would actually give you more resources in the bricks and mortar schools to offer more of those journalism classes to those students. So it seems like the cap is sort of arbitrary and doesn't really seem to have a good public purpose. So can you explain to me why I'm wrong on that?
Chair Haas, Senator George, again, from a district perspective, and I remember the conversations that we had in previous legislative sessions when we put the caps on the extended options, et cetera. But in this case, there's a mandate that you must allow at least up to 5%, but it's not a cap saying you cannot go beyond. So a district that says, you're absolutely right, I've got, 10 kids who need calculus, and it's cheaper for me to buy this in the virtual environment. I don't have a teacher that can teach it, but this district or these districts collectively over here have enough students that we can create it. It makes absolute sense from both the financial perspective of the district, but also meeting the needs of the students. And so that has been what the Balance Act has been. So in this language, 5% may seem low, but it is really a 5% mandate. You must allow at least up to that, but it is not a cap saying you can't go beyond. Using the districts that I've been talking to, there are a number of them that are looking at kind of peaks and valleys of when needs and opportunities exist, and the 5% isn't an issue when we're talking to them. It really is looking at the flow of the school year and when can we be offering classes that would tie up to when their students will need them.
Thank you.
I guess if there's no further questions, I just I don't want to speak for the committee, but I think there's one central question that we're all kind of struggling with, and that is we know that this virtual world is growing fast.
Yeah.
And what is, I think what some of us, at least me, trying to figure out is what is the problem that exists today in our school system that this bill solves?
Start. Chair Haas, Lori Wimmer again. We believe that the number one greatest desire from students who want to access online learning is the course-by-course access. And we want to make sure that that access can be expanded statewide while simultaneously balancing
the needs of districts and local control, the financial realities of the state, the regulatory struggles of a department that is diminishing in size every biennium, and all of those other moving parts. This is a very complicated issue. We want to be able to serve all kids in the very best high-quality way possible, in a way that's accountable and transparent and affordable. We believe that this method, which has, as I said, a soft mandate, balances against the local control perspective of local managers of school districts, and also balances the choice and options desire of the consumer of education against the fiscal realities of the state. We're trying to take in all of those various complexities and provide the very best, easiest to understand, easiest to access, affordable, accountable, high-quality program we can, and we felt this was the best way to do it.
Thank you. We have by virtue of testimony that has come before this committee in previous sessions, I would judge a pretty vibrant, active virtual school, charter school community presence attending. Were they included in the preparation and the deliberations of this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, not in the drafting of the bill, but we did offer the Dash 3 amendments to advocates for that community and wrote them explicitly with that in mind to preserve what they have going now. And also I would say that all through the several years of work on the various policy issues around online education, we have all worked together in work groups. This bill is a genesis from that process. And so, yes, we've worked on and frankly struggled over a number of issues. We start out from a position of saying, look, our goal is to provide service where it is not being provided now, not with the comprehensive. They are not allowed under Oregon's charter school law to just do course by course. And that is the by far greater level of demand, percentage-wise, than those who seek the comprehensive.
Did you consider, if I may follow up, consider amending existing law to allow that to happen on a course-by-course basis? What strikes me, just be very candid, what strikes me as strange is to go down a path that's so disconnected from what is already existing in the state that provides, by the testimony that has come to us from parents and the children themselves, a very valuable education experience. It just seems like that it's been a total disconnect, and now we're going to run into a different direction. And even to the extent of the curriculum that I've seen is, you know, it's very well developed. It's serving the purposes apparently very well. Why that was never considered as a resource for our official state virtual school district?
Chair Hess, Senator Morris, I don't want to leave you with the impression that we ignored any asset, any resource, any curriculum out there. Like I said, we had a group of folks that looked at a variety of courses. We have a variety of courses, both public, private sector providers, et cetera, that exist on the Oregon Virtual School District site. For the beginning classes of this delivery system, we chose primarily the Florida Virtual School classes because they were designed specifically for this online environment and the interactive online environment, not the cold, just beam it out to a student and they're on their own. So it was really looking at trying to find the courses that, again, this group reviewed best practice and said, we believe these courses are the best ones to move forward with. It doesn't mean that next year it might be some other, you know, provider that has an even better, you know, 2.0 version that is added to the Oregon Virtual School District library that we choose to use. In part, I think part of the problem is maybe for both Lori and I is we've been in these various meetings over the last few years with the interim work study and everything else where, again, we try to separate the idea of charter and virtual. And so it is not my intent today in testifying in favor of this to say anything about shutting down charter schools. The agreement that I remember coming out of those work sessions and what led my effort and the team I put together effort in creating the Oregon Virtual Ed piece was that agreement that let's create an umbrella where everyone that wants to participate can participate as long as we all agree to the same rules. And so that's what we worked on. That's been our focus. That's what the Dash 3, as far as the virtual education piece, should reflect. And we believe it comes close to reflecting. And I see that Rachel has something that she would like to have, if you don't mind.
Chair Haas, Senator Morse, I'm going to speak now in my ever-changing hat as a parent of a student who is getting ready to take online courses. And I think, and I respect that we have many people in the room who probably have similar or different stories, but I believe in my local school district. I'm very happy with what they do. I love my students' teachers. I love my community. But there are certain individual courses that my son, who's ready to move maybe a year or two ahead of where he is right now, does not have access to because of the structure of our school district and, in this year, the looming budget and layoffs. So if there are options that I, as a parent who would like to stay as involved as possible with the structures that we've built up over the years and the community that we've built around our public school system, if there's an option where I can enroll my student and my child in a course that he needs that still allows him to be a complete and whole member of his existing structure, I'm all for that. And I, as I understand this bill, that moves us a step closer to that situation where I don't have to have, my son doesn't have to kind of walk a line between what's offered in a charter setting and just his school setting. And maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I, to me, that would be one of the benefits.
Thank you,
this.
All three. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to get kicked out of our room here in about 20 minutes, so you have a lot of people to move through. Let's start off with Rob Kramer. Rob, you have a team, or you solo today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Kramer. I'm here representing Connections Academy, which is one of the vendors for the charter school virtual world here in Oregon. They provide the curriculum and proprietary learning system for the Oregon Connections Academy Charter School, which serves about 2,500 kids here in the state of Oregon. I first testified here in front of the Senate Education Committee on issues of charter schools back in 1995. Between 1995 and 1999, when finally the charter school law was passed and signed into law by then Governor Kitzhaber, we had great hopes that the charter school law would spur some kinds of innovations in Oregon public school arena. That finally came to pass with the development of 100-plus charter schools, and in 2005, the first virtual charter school in the state of Oregon, the Oregon Connections Academy. And I was involved also in the founding of that school, getting it approved, operating in the Scioto School District, and starting in the 2005-2006 school year. Now, literally since before the ink was barely dry on the contract signed between Oregon Connections Academy and the Scioto School District, there were legislative attacks on virtual schools in Oregon, starting with Senate Bill 1071, which you may remember, which established the famous 50% provision. Before the school was even open, they tried to require any virtual charter school or charter school offering virtual courses get half of its students from the sponsoring school district, an obvious poison pill thrown into the mix to try to prevent this school from opening. It didn't work with regards to Oregon Connections Academy because it had signed its charter contract prior to the date the law was passed. And so it got basically a five-year stay of execution until the term of its first contract was it had expired. That school was allowed to exist in current form. After it expired, it was supposed to comply with this 50% provision, and then it would have to go get a waiver from the State Board of Education, which had the power to waive that provision of charter law. In 2007, there was a bill to try to move that 50, that waiver authority away from the state board so it couldn't give the waivers for virtual charter schools to operate in Oregon. In 2009, I'm sure you all remember Senate Bill 767, which was an overt attempt to close down virtual charter schools in Oregon. Now, I just bring that as a perspective because the 2,500 parents or students in Connections Academy and the 600 or so now students in the Oregon Virtual Academy have literally felt as if they have been under attack for the last 6 years, and all they really want is an education for their students. So we weren't all that surprised when we saw Senate Bill 927 come thrown into the mix this session, because in the original form of its bill, it would have done the same thing, essentially said to the existing virtual charter schools, sorry, you're not legitimate, you're not valid, you have to change the way you operate in very significant ways in the original form. Now, during the course of these years in 2005 through 2011, the State Board of Education was, of course, instrumental in evaluating these waiver requests that it had from Connections Academy, from West Lane, from some other virtual schools, and indeed from Oregon Virtual Academy as well. The State Board, as you know, did a lot of policy work to ask the question, exactly how should charter schools be governed in the state of Oregon? And they struggled with this year in, year out, culminating last summer. At the direction of the legislature, they were supposed to come up with a governance plan, which they met time and time and time again, had work groups, and we all had a chance to provide our input, and they came up with the plan in their white paper now, which has been essentially baked into House Bill 2301. Now, the structure for virtual school governance, which is established or attempted to be established in Senate Bill 927, was presented to the State Board as part of the discussion. It was in the mix of the discussion. It was never presented until last summer. So for 5 years, we never heard anything about this, but it was thrown into the mix during the State Board negotiations and meetings last summer, and the State Board decided that, no, that wasn't the direction they thought the state should go. It went in the direction that is now part of House Bill 2301. So the Dash 3 amendments, which have been offered to 927, which basically exempt the existing virtual charter schools that have a waiver from the State Board of Education and allow them to continue while the rest of 927 is put in place. As someone who represents one of these private vendors who now basically are offered the prospect of having a virtual monopoly along with one other or two other providers in the virtual school space in Oregon, you would expect that they would jump at such an offer and say, wow, we'll have pretty much the whole market to ourselves and we'll be able to serve everybody who wants these services. You would think that they would jump at it. Well, they don't, and we don't, because the point of virtual schooling and the point of school choice is not to create new monopolies in public education. The point is to allow innovation to flourish because that's what serves parents and children the best. And so public policy, this would be bad public policy to create yet another monopoly or fiefdom that has individual operators guaranteed access to students. That's not what this is about. It misses the whole point of why we think virtual schools and charter schools are good things for students and parents and teachers in the state of Oregon in the first place. Now, Mr. Chair, you asked a question about the structures in 927, which I thought was straight to the point. You asked, what does this allow you to do that you couldn't do now with regards to the consortium and the clearinghouse? And really, there's nothing. There's nothing to prevent them from establishing that kind of consortium, that kind of clearinghouse now, where everybody who comes to them knows that the courses offered through the consortium and clearinghouse have been vetted by their people and have certified teachers. Nothing prevents them from doing that without a bill. All this bill does is require all individual courses offered through the Internet to go through the clearinghouse. And so, in essence, it's a way for the education establishment to control the virtual schooling that's offered in Oregon. Now, I found it very interesting that they would still allow full-time virtual schools to go through the alternative ed law. The alternative ed law does not require any certified teachers. You can be a private alternative ed school in Oregon without a single certified teacher. As long as you can get a school district to have a contract with you to send children to it, you don't have to have any certified teachers. So if that's the point of this, is to maintain standards as far as certification and course content and meeting curriculum standards, alternative ed schools in Oregon are not held to those same standards, so I found it odd that that's kind of the escape valve from the clearinghouse for schools that want to come to create full-time virtual schools in the state of Oregon. So in sum, I'll just end with, it seems on the face of it, it would be attractive for private operators who are now offering this service in the state of Oregon to jump at being offered a monopoly, but they don't, because they don't think that's good public policy for the state of Oregon or for any other state. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've got a list here. I'll try to get to some of these people, especially those who have driven more than 100 miles away. And got Daryl Hall-Crimson. I'll call you up, and we'll do this three at a time. Jessica Cousineau and Eli Justman. No need to read your testimony, and if you could keep it at a minute or two, that would be great.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Cousineau, and I want to thank you for allowing me to come and speak today. I'm the mother of four children, four school-age children, and a practicing attorney. Three of my children go to the local bricks and mortar elementary, Charles F. Tigard, of which I'm the PSO president and have been many years. One of them, my oldest, is enrolled as an eighth grader at ORCA at Connections Academy, and he's been there since halfway through his sixth grade year. I read through the Dash 3 amendments quickly after we got here. I'd heard about them before, but I hadn't actually had a chance to read them because we were informed about them late last night. So I'm trying to tailor my testimony to them specifically, and I hope you'll bear with me. Despite the new amendments, I don't support this bill. I'm afraid that it will still stifle education past an acceptable limit. As a parent of multiple children, I know how different each one is, how different they learn, and even in a situation where they have the same two parents and they're raised in the same way, how differently they react to different stimuli. ORCA works very well for my oldest son now, and I'll be glad when we no longer have to come down here time and time and time again to advocate for it. I'll be glad when we can just sit there and let him learn in the way that's best for him. But I think this bill, as it currently sits, will do him a greater disservice, even if it grandfathers in his current situation. Technology is moving almost faster than we can imagine. When I was in middle school or high school, I would never have dreamt of taking classes on the computer. Correspondence courses meant you wrote it out and you mailed it in, and some number of weeks later you got some response you hoped. That's nowhere near what my son gets in what is traditionally viewed as a correspondence education. What he gets is one-on-one education with teachers, with other students, with interaction on a daily basis. What he gets is an education that is tailored to his learning style, to his learning speed. He's a tag student. He was very bored at his other school. He's now moved along far enough that as a by grade or by age eighth grader, he is taking high school classes. I was really hoping that when we started with ORCA, he would have access to a lot of AP courses because their brochures, and at the time they provided those. Senator George, I want to thank you for noticing that some of these teachers who were teaching the AP courses are no longer allowed to teach in Oregon, not because they're poor teachers, not because they don't have teaching certifications in other states, but because they have not come down to Oregon to sit for our teaching certification. I would be very interested in a provision that would allow teachers in other states to also be allowed to teach here, as long as their certification is comparable.
Jessica, we need you to...
Yeah. I will finish up. As I close, I just want to, again, keep in mind that it worries me that we're limiting our educational opportunities with this bill. We're keeping them to the to the mechanisms that were available when I was a student, or even that are available today. I think we need to keep in mind that as technology matures and as technology advances, we need to allow that open access for those technologies to benefit our children. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eli Justman. I live here in Salem. I go to Willamette University at the School of Law, and I'm a lawmaking process student there. So I'm sort of here for school, but over the course of the last 6 months, we've done a lot of work in my project group in this particular issue, very narrowly, actually, in the issue of providing individualized courses to students. I'll also say I'm a father of three, and I myself come from a very alternative education background, homeschooled, private schooled, just about anything you can imagine. I have some reservations about this bill, but my group and I have talked a lot about it, and we think it's important for the committee to keep in mind that increasing equity in the classes in online education in our public schools is very important. The more we dug around on this issue as we went through the year working on it, the more we found a crazy patchwork quilt of what's available to students in public schools. You never know what you're going to get. ESDs and districts have got all sorts of different resources. Nobody knows what anybody else has. And we're living in the 21st century when information is delivered in new and exciting and better ways. And I think a lot of the virtual school people who are here can speak to that, of course. Which is why I'm glad to see that the proposed amendments, would protect their schools. I think that's pretty important. So, in short, as a parent and as somebody who's kind of been watching this issue, I do urge your support of the bill. But I would just keep in mind that the goal should be to help these students in schools get taking courses that are available out there, but they're just distributed in completely unreasonable ways. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Darrell Hargrimson, and I submitted a... I don't want to take up any more time. We see this as a regulatory means of... taking over the educational options that we put forward for our children. My daughter's been in Orva for 3 years. She flourishes. She excels in some classes, in some classes she doesn't, which gives my wife and I the opportunity to work with her with those extra classes. And we just don't believe that this bill is going to open up options for educating our children. And I'll yield my time to anybody else.
Appreciate that. Appreciate you coming over. And, where are you from?
Dayton.
Dayton. Okay.
Questions?
Thank you. I've seen some state reps come in and out, and I didn't... Okay. You're all right? Thanks. Karen Hikus. Karen, did you want to come up with anyone else?
Mr. Chair, as Karen's coming up, can I just make a brief comment? Because I'm glad to hear Eli's testimony, because the reason I put my name on the bill was for the reasons that Eli talked about, that I really see it as an equity issue, and as somebody who sat through a lot of testimony in the past couple of sessions on this issue, I'm supporting the need to increase online education opportunities, and I was really glad to hear the testimony of somebody who's a parent who's actually been looking at what he called the patchwork of classes out there, and so I really appreciated his testimony and wanted to clarify my intent on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You know what got me with Eli is that he's in law school, he has three kids, and he has time to be here.
Never sleep.
Hate to do this to you, but we have about 3 minutes.
Yep.
We'll talk fast. Senator Haas, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hikas. I'm the director of the Northwest Center for Educational Options, which represents charter schools in this state. The vast majority of charter schools in this state are members of our organization, including quite a few online schools that have not been mentioned yet, like West Lane Tech, Clackamas Web Academy, which opened in 2004, so actually was the first virtual school in the state. CharterWise, Gresham Web Academy, Resource Link, All Prep Charter Schools. So we have quite a few charter schools in this state that would fall under the definition of a virtual charter school that are impacted by all of these deliberations that we've had. I've been at the table on this issue for about 6 years, been involved in every iteration, every group with the legislature, with the state board, during the interim, during session, et cetera, and this is a complicated issue, and it's a controversial issue. So I want to talk about this bill and some of the concepts that our organization supports that are in this bill. First would be quality standards. We absolutely support that. We always have. Equitable access by students. Any students who would want to participate in online learning, we support that. We support professional development for teachers who are teaching online courses so that they're effectively equipped to do so. We support the Oregon Virtual School District's current services, and we do support the concept of separating charter schools from virtual schools with preserving parental choice. Those are the pieces we support. Some of the concerns we have, just a little confusing, first of all, some of the language, and I know that we have had the dash ones, dash twos, dash threes. I believe that the dash threes will give a permanent grandfather to existing virtual charter schools, but it's really still a little confusing to me, the way that sections 13 and 14 read. And I am concerned about a monopoly situation, but I'm mostly concerned about preserving existing schools, so I appreciate it if indeed the dash threes do that. I do have questions about the word may, which is used throughout this bill multiple times, and I'm wondering whether or not this consortium, if all the online courses and the kids that want to take online courses must go through this or just may go through this, and if it's a may and not a must, then how are we doing what we say we're doing in terms of providing consistency, quality standards, et cetera, et cetera. So I just think there's still some confusing pieces that we need to work to clarify. But I just wanted to weigh in because charter schools, of course, have been seriously impacted by this whole conversation all along because most of the comprehensive virtual schools are in the charter school law right now. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you.
I'm Ken Woody. I'm director of West Lane Technical Learning Center, a charter high school. Online, we also have an auto electric vehicle program that works with high school students of neighboring high school. We serve 120 students, ages grades 9 through 12. Most of the kids that come to us are 1 to 2 years behind, and 40% are at reading and math levels of fifth grade. They come to us from highly qualified teachers in another place. A lot of times they've been left behind. The irony to me about this bill is that the word option is in the title. To me, the losers in this bill are the students and the parents. This is an assault on local control in the sense that our school board, my school board, a lot of the things that we have the ability to do under OSR 338 are taken away by this bill. It's a assault on parental choice, which I think is important, and you eliminate parental choice here and you're going to eliminate a very important part of the move to make education better and more relevant. It also is an assault on innovation and creativity, ORS 338. It hurts the kids most. Now, West Lane Tech, now I appreciate OEA wanting to have us to have quality standards, but we have a contract with our district, and under ORS 338, we have very high standards. We have higher standards than the average school. We are accredited by the Northwest Accreditation Commission, and our curriculum is aligned to the state of Oregon requirements. We don't want someone else to tell us what we need for our curriculum. I have two highly qualified teachers that our board and we hired. We don't need someone else to hire our teachers for us. We want our teachers to reflect the values of our district and of the kids that we need. Our teachers are very skilled in online education. They are going to create curriculum that is beyond what the providers provide us. We use Odysseyware, and we use Alex.
I thank you. I hate to interrupt you here. We're winding down here. And,
thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're not going to take any action on this bill today. I know there's some people who wanted to testify. We ran out of time. We're going to carry this over until Thursday. And we're going to carry over as well Senate Bills 909, 245, and 175. Ken Curran, thank you.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.